Walter Sports Bar in Navy Yard offers $5 happy hour in both snacks and drinks. To reserve a table, visit waltersdc.com/happy hour.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Here's the set now. And the 1-2 again on the way. Swing and a base hit through the hole into right field. Stott scores from third. Castellanos coming home. Thomas thrown to the plate will not be in time. He slides across with run number three. As Schwarber comes through on 1-2, and it's a three-run inning for the Phillies and a 3-0 second inning lead.
Here's the 1-0. Breaking ball, line drive, base hit right field. Schwarber will score. Ball bobbled by Thomas. Turner stops, though, and stays put as the throw-in is cut off. So it's 4-0 Phillies. Harper, the RBI, his seventh of the year.
And welcome to Nats Chat for Saturday, April 6, 2024, along with MazinSports.com Nationals insider Mark Zuckerman, who is at Nationals Park. I'm Al Galdi, host of the Al Galdi podcast. Not a good start to the Nationals weekend, a 4-0 loss to the Philadelphia Phillies at Nationals Park on a cold Friday night in game one of a three-game series, and in a game in which the Nats totaled a mere two hits. Now, the Nats did work five walks, but Nats pitchers combined to issue nine walks, although that Nats pitching performance did include Patrick Corbin becoming the first Nats pitcher to throw at least six innings in a game in this regular season, and did include three Nats relievers somehow combining for three scoreless and hitless innings. This was an odd game, but the Nats now are 2-5 in this regular season. The Nats over their two wins have totaled 12 runs. The Nats over their five losses have totaled just 15 runs. You know, Mark, it's funny. The Nats got to the Phillies ace, Aaron Nola. He got out of the game after just 5 2/3 innings, so got to him from a standpoint of getting him out of the game prior to him completing six innings. Patrick Corbin lasted longer than Aaron Nola did, but the Nats still wound up with just the two hits and wound up with another loss.
Think of it in these terms, Al. If I told you going into this game that Patrick Corbin would reach the seventh inning against the Phillies, you'd probably think to yourself, okay, that's about as much as you could possibly ask with that matchup. And it probably turned into a good night for the Nats, or at least a very competitive game where they had a chance to win late. And instead, it was not even close to that. Once they were down 3-0 early, it felt like they never had any chance to come back in this one because they did nothing of consequence at the plate. And so while Corbin was far from perfect, I'm not going to, you know, throw too many compliments his way, he did about as best as you could ask for under the circumstances. And if you just get any semblance of offense from his teammates, you might actually have a chance of winning this game. But they did nothing. This was a pretty lifeless performance. I don't care how many pitches you made Aaron Nola or their relievers throw. You didn't threaten except for maybe once the entire game at the plate.
Davey Martinez, early in his postgame press conference with you guys, referenced it being cold on Friday night.
It was cold.
Yes, it was, but that does not excuse two hits in a game. The Phillies had nine hits in this game to go with the Phillies' nine walks. This really was just a nothing-happening performance for the Nats in this game. Jesse Winker drew two walks. Joey Gallo drew two walks. And that's about it in terms of like any real offensive bright spot. I mean, Luis Garcia Jr. did have another double. So, you know, there was that bottom of the third, a leadoff opposite field double to the left center field gap. But even in that inning, we ended up having a blunder by the Nats. So the Nats in that bottom of the third actually had two hits. Both of the hits came in that inning. C.J. Abrams had a one-out single to right field. But two interesting things happened on that play. Number one, Garcia did not score on that play. Now, I don't know that it was necessarily easy to score, but interesting that he doesn't score on that play. And then Abrams got thrown out at second base on that play.
Long set. Now the pitch to the plate. Swing a line drive right field. That's a base hit. Garcia's going to get the stop sign with Castellanos throwing it in. Abrams keeps on running to second. Harper's throw there is in time for the out. Oh, the Nationals run into one there.
it looked like Abrams did not properly read the throw from the Phillies right fielder Nick Castellanos to the infield. The throw got cut off by the Phillies first baseman, our old pal Bryce Harper, and then he threw the ball to another ex-Nat shortstop, Trey Turner, who tagged out Abrams at second base. What did you see on that Abrams single?
Yeah, so from my vantage point way up high above home plate, you actually do have a good view of those kind of plays, and I think I have a pretty good sense often of decisions when it comes to rounding third or should the runner take the extra base, stuff like that. The first thing, I thought it was the right call by Ricky Gutierrez to hold Garcia at third. The way he runs, the timing of when he crossed third base, when Castellanos let go of the ball, he might have scored, but I think he's probably out with a halfway decent throw to the plate, and I'm just not sure that you want to make that out at the plate in that spot. So I don't really have a problem with Garcia not scoring on the play. As far as Abrams goes, I think he just had his head down. He saw Castellanos make the throw, and I think just assumed the throw was going all the way to the plate. And if that's true, that is the right move to try to take second. But you got to recognize the height of the ball and not, you have to realize that there's a chance it's going to be cut off, which it was by Harper, who made the throw to second. Abrams, when he slid in, it looked like he was down for a little while, and you thought, oh, did he do something? I think he might have jammed his hand or something with a finger. It turned out it was fine. I don't think it affected him at all. But on a night when you had so little going offensively, you just can't afford to make any outs on the bases. And it's an out of aggression, but it's also an out that if you're just paying a little more closely attention to all of this, I think you realize immediately that that throw was going to be cut off and you can slam on the brakes and get back to first base.
And as we've said before, when you don't do much offensively, a play like that stands out. Whereas otherwise, if you're doing stuff offensively, a play like that ends up being an oh, by the way play. I want to get into Lane Thomas. Man, is he off to a rough start to this season. Lane Thomas on Friday night as the Nats starting right fielder and number two batter, 0 for 4 with a strikeout. His OPS for this regular season now, and it's only 7 games, we get that, but his OPS is 227. That would be bad for a batting average. That's his OPS on the season, 227. Lane Thomas is 2 for 28 with 3 walks. Both hits have been singles. His slash line is a 071 batting average, a 156 on base, and a 071 slugging. Do you think we're reaching the point at which Lane Thomas gets a mental break, an off day, for the purposes of just kind of collecting himself? It has been a real struggle for him so far.
It has, and I get what you're saying, but I don't know that they have the depth to account for that. As far as the outfield's concerned, I guess you could do something where you start Jacob Young in center and then have like Eddie Rosario play right field for the day. I suppose you could do that. My hunch is that they're not thinking of those terms yet. Lane really is an everyday player. And honestly, I think he's probably the kind of guy who is better served staying out there and trying to work his way through it than sitting. Because the results have not been good, absolutely. But I do feel like he's hitting the ball a little harder and probably deserves a little better results than he's getting. I'm looking at it right now, and it's only a limited number of at-bats, obviously. But he's got a 33% line drive rate, you know, which is very good. It's way better than his average or anything else. He hit a ball really well on the screws to left field in the first inning this game, reached the warning track, maybe on a warmer day without the wind blowing in. They might have even had a chance to clear the fence or go off the wall for a double. I feel he has had a few loud outs already this season. Now, that doesn't mean that all the at-bats have been good, and they haven't. And right after that play we were talking about where Abrams was thrown out at second, Lane comes up still with a chance, a runner on third and two outs to do something, and he strikes out looking. So it's not like every one of these has been good quality at bats. But I do feel like he's been a little bit the victim of some bad luck. We know he got off to a slow start last year in April and then got red hot after that and had a great May, and most of the summer was excellent. So I'm not overly concerned. I think it stands out right now because the team as a whole is not hitting, and he's obviously in a prime position as their number two hitter and one of their better hitters, that when he struggles, along with some others, it really stands out and it's noticeable.
Tim Shover is here to tell you about Game Time. On Tuesday, April 8th, Bad Bunny is coming to Capital One Arena. Now, personally, I did not think he did a particularly good job as an SNL host earlier this season, but I'm confident sketch comedy will not be the focal point of this concert. One great thing about Game Time is their priority, last-minute deals. Save up to 60% off buying last minute for sports, concerts, comedy, and theater. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code NATSCHAT for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code NATSCHAT for $20 off. Download the Game Time app today. Last minute tickets, lowest price, guaranteed.
And the pitch is rolled up the third base line, fair inside the line. Lipscomb has it. He'll gear up a throw high. Airmails Gallo. The ball stays in play. Castellanos rounds first. The ball backed up in right field by Thomas off the netting. And so Castellanos will scamper back to first. And that'll be the second throwing error on the homestand for Trey Lipscomb.
Well, it is interesting. The Nats right now with multiple outfielders on the 10-day injured list in Victor Robles and Stone Garrett did have Trey Lipscomb getting some outfield work prior to this game on Friday. So perhaps we do see Lipscomb in the outfield at some point soon. It was interesting, I thought, with Lipscomb in this game on Friday night. So starting third baseman, number 9 batter, 0-for-3 with a couple of strikeouts. He had a throwing error. So his second throwing error in three games, top of the fourth, he airmailed another throw. This was a leadoff grounder by Nick Castellanos. But I do want to give Lipscomb credit for this. Top of the third, I thought he made a really nice catch on what was a low one-hop throw by Patrick Corbin from across the diamond on what ended up being a really wild play. The play began with Corbin having JT Realmuto in a rundown between first base and second base, and the play resulted in Bryce Harper being tagged out in a rundown between third base and home plate.
Throw over to first. Realmuto gets hung up. Gallo looking at him, throws to Garcia, chasing him toward the plate, looking at Harper too, throws to Corbin. Now Harper breaks for the plate. Now Corbin's going to throw the ball to third. Bounces it. Lipscomb has it. Harper's caught in his rundown, throws to Ruiz, chasing Harper toward third. Now gives the ball off to Gallo. Tag out there, throw to second, and the ball's dropped by Garcia, or it might have been a double play.
The official scoring on the play, 1-3-4-1-5-2-3, which is not Mark Zuckerman's telephone number, in case you're curious, but that was the scoring on that play. But Lipscomb with these throws lately, been a bit off. We know defense is something he's very good at, but a little off with the throws here these last few games.
So think about the opening weekend in Cincinnati, maybe the first game or two against the Pirates. He was skipping some throws to first and getting bailed out by Joey Gallo. And you just wonder in the back of his mind if he might be overcompensating for that and now trying to put a little more on it. And he's airmailed two of them for errors. So, you know, this guy has played great defense throughout the minor leagues. Third base is his most comfortable and natural position. And that's where he's going to play for now while Nick Senzel is injured. So I don't think this is a case of a guy who's not going to be comfortable in the field. I think it just may take a little time to get used to being in the big leagues and get the feel for it all. I think he'll be all right there. I don't think they're that concerned about that. But I do think it's notable that after bouncing several throws in those first few games, he's now airmailing a few. And my guess is, subconsciously or not, he's overcompensating for that. That pickoff play, you know, they work on a lot of stuff in spring training. I don't think I've seen him quite work on that exact play like that. But give him credit. They got the job done. And, you know, I couldn't help but think as I'm watching this, we remember Bryce Harper on third base as a rookie with a runner on first facing the Phillies and Cole Hamels. And what did he do? Stole home when they tried to pick off at first. So this was kind of the same play. And the Nats, whether they knew their history or not, were ready for it. They handled it quite well. Now, you know, it took a lot of throws to get it done. And I think the most amazing part to me is that the final person with the ball in his hand making the tag near third base is Joey Gallo, the first baseman. So credit to him for, after making his throw, following in line where you're supposed to and being a part of that rundown on the complete opposite side of the infield. So wasn't necessarily the prettiest thing, but they got it done. And it's too bad that this wasn't a more entertaining and close game, because that might be a play we talked about as, hey, good on them for cutting down a run that could have been scored on them.
That Harper play from 2012 is so famous for so many different reasons. Happened on Sunday Night Baseball, right? Led to Cole Hamels not being happy, and then led to Mike Rizzo just shredding Cole Hamels in one of the all-time great Mike Rizzo rants. So regarding Lipscomb getting some outfield work before the game, just for emergency purposes, I mean, his history is such that he has not played much outfield. He played a little bit in college, but that's basically it.
Yeah, it sounds like this is more of an emergency kind of thing. Certainly right now, they are focused on him at third base. There could come a point here when Nick Senzel comes back that maybe they look at him at second base. Although Luis Garcia is playing really well here in the first week of the season, and that could change the calculus a little bit. I think this is one of those like, hey, maybe someday he could be a super utility guy that we use all over the field. Remember, Davey mentioned him, kind of reminding him of Ben Zobrist back during spring training. So it might be those thoughts. But for now, I would not look for him to start a game in the outfield. Certainly, it would probably just be a scenario where if during the course of a game things happen that required some moving around, they want him to at least be comfortable enough that they could put him out there if they had to.
Well, regarding Patrick Corbin, so he on Friday evening made it through six innings. First time we've had that with an Nats pitcher in this regular season. Ultimately allowed four runs in the six innings. Gave up nine hits, which were comprised of three doubles and six singles. He issued three walks. He did record six strikeouts, and he did throw a lot of strikes. 93 pitches, 65 strikes versus just 28 balls. You could argue that he pitched better than that final line of four runs in six innings suggests. He tossed scoreless first, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth innings, although not a single one of those innings was a clean inning, although the inning in which Lipscomb committed that throwing error would have been a clean inning if not for that throwing error. The damage came in the top of the second, or the initial damage anyway. Corbin, in that top of the second, allowed three runs on two singles, two walks, and an RBI sac fly. And then Corbin, in the top of the seventh, allowed a run by allowing each of the first three batters in the inning, all of whom are ex-Nats who made up the top three batters in the Phillies lineup to reach base. Corbin issued a leadoff walk of Kyle Schwarber, gave up a first pitch opposite field double by Trey Turner to the right center field gap, and gave up an RBI single by Bryce Harper to right field for a 4-0 Phillies lead. There is that standard Patrick Corbin grading curve of for him versus how you would judge most other starting pitchers in MLB, but for him, this was not a particularly bad outing.
For him and against this lineup, I think you put those two together, and absolutely you would take this from him. And in my mind, this was a quality start, the first quality start by Nationals pitcher this year, because I would have pulled him after the sixth. You got six innings out of Patrick Corbin and three runs allowed, all of them early, and then came back to pitch well after that. I would not have pressed my luck there. I would have taken him out after six and said, hey, you know what? Good job. That's about as best as we could ask for you on this night. Now, the way it started, it did not look like it was going to be a good night at all. That second inning was ugly. And the start of the third inning was looking bad with the runners on the corners and nobody out. And then thanks to that pickoff play, it kind of bailed him out. But credit to him, he not only started pitching much more effectively after that, but much more efficiently, where, you know, he was at 54 pitches after the third inning. You're not thinking he's going to get to the seventh at that point, but much more efficient. 14 pitches in the fourth, only six pitches in the fifth, and then 10 pitches in the sixth. And so I know why Davey is thinking 84 pitches total. The bullpen's been kind of used up a lot here early on. You're in this stretch now without any off days for a while. Let's try to get more out of him. But Patrick Corbin facing Schwarber, Turner, and Harper for the fourth time in a game, that to me was a recipe for disaster. There was no chance he was navigating his way through that. And sure enough, he didn't walk, double, single. Another run comes in, and now you're making the move to the bullpen anyways.
And you wonder if other Nat starters had gone longer in some recent games, if maybe Davey would not have felt that impetus to try to push it with Patrick Corbin. But obviously, that did not work out. And it's funny, Davey did still end up using three relievers in this game. Now, I found what happened with the Nats bullpen in this game so comical, because you got three scoreless and hitless innings from three relievers. Normally you say, well, that's a good outing for your bullpen. Yet these three guys combined to issue six walks and a balk. And two of these guys in particular were upside down in terms of strikes versus balls. So there really was a lot to process here. So Jordan Weems came into the game, top of the seventh, runners at the corners, nobody out, Nats down 4-0, got out of the jam, induced a 1-3 ground out by JT Realmuto, did then issue a one out four pitch walk of Alec Bohm, but then induced a one out bases loaded 4-6-3 double play off the bat of Bryson Stott. Then we had the latest in the adventures of Tanner Rainey. A scoreless top of the eighth. So you say, okay, that's good. Well, not exactly. He issued three consecutive one-out walks, but he then induced a one-out, bases-loaded, 4-3 double play off the bat of Trey Turner for the final two outs. That was a nice double play that was turned, by the way, by Luis Garcia Jr. But Rainey in this inning threw 27 pitches, just 13 strikes versus 14 balls. And then came Matt Barnes. He tossed a scoreless top of the ninth. He began that scoreless top of the ninth by recording back-to-back swinging strikeouts of Bryce Harper and JT Realmuto. So you say, okay, Matt Barnes is on his way to a nice outing. But Barnes then issued back-to-back two-out walks, then issued a two-out balk to put the runners on second and third. But Barnes then recorded the third out. But you look at Barnes's inning, 26 pitches, just 11 strikes versus a whopping 15 balls. This may be the single worst three scoreless and hitless innings from a bullpen in the history of baseball. This really was something on Friday night.
It was not real easy to watch, I will tell you that. And I'm sure for everybody sitting out there in the cold, it was even worse to endure through all that. You know, credit where credit's due. They got out of it somehow. But boy, the path to get there was not pretty at all. In Rainey's case, and I noted this on Twitter, 88 pitches in three innings of work over the last 5 days for a guy trying to make his way back from Tommy John surgery. Wow, that is a lot. And, you know, this was back-to-back days, so the first time that he's done that, it's just not looking clean yet for him. And you keep putting him out there as long as he's feeling healthy, and you hope that he, over time, starts to get that feeling back and becomes a reliable reliever for you. But at this point, it's pretty clear that he's not all the way back from all this and hasn't really been all that effective and is throwing a ton of pitches. And that does concern me somewhat. I get why he's out there, and I'm not saying that Davey is abusing him or that there's no justification for him being out there, and you don't know these innings are going to go as long as they do. But man, if anybody out there is in need of a 10-pitch, 1-2-3 inning, Tanner Rainey is the one who needs that for certain.
You just hope he's feeling all right. But he certainly has not looked all right so far this season. I mean, that is as clear as can be. I was thinking about this with the Nats bullpen, and it's appropriate that this comes up because it was earlier on Friday that our old pal, the secret weapon, Paolo Espino, was selected to the Major League roster by the Toronto Blue Jays and was active for their game on Friday. So a salute to our guy Paolo for being back in the majors. But who is the Nats' Paolo Espino for this season? Who is their long man? You know, if the starter gets knocked out of the game in the first or second inning, who's capable of coming into the game and providing 3-4 innings of relief?
Yeah, that is an issue that they don't really have that guy as it currently stands. Now, you have several who can go 2, maybe 3 in some cases. I think Derek Law, Robert Garcia, perhaps Jordan Weems could do it. He could probably go 2 innings if needed, but they don't have that traditional, here's the guy you go to when starter gets knocked out early. And that's a function of how things worked out this spring, of how effective all these guys were in spring training. We talked about it at the end of camp, how they were cutting veteran relievers with good track records and good spring training numbers because they just didn't have spots for everyone. But by having Trevor Williams be the number 5 starter and by cutting Zach Davies, who just didn't, you know, do enough to earn a job himself, they put them in this spot where they don't really have a long man. So there is no Paolo Espino in the current bullpen. And something else I was thinking about the other day, it's a good thing you have veterans, you have guys with track records in the bullpen. Here's the flip side of that, though. They only have a few guys with minor league options. Robert Garcia has options. And actually, Kyle Finnegan and Hunter Harvey both do. I mean, you hope it doesn't come to that, that they would need to do it. But the rest of them are out of options. And so you don't have that ability. Say you need to use a bunch of relievers one night or over the course of a few days. You don't really have that ability to send somebody down, call somebody else up, get a fresh arm up here. That's not going to happen this early in the year, but at some point that could come into play where they don't have the maneuverability that they have often had over the years with relievers because pretty much everybody in the group is a veteran and almost all of them are out of options.
Here's your first Dylan Cruz update for 2024 as the Harrisburg Senators began their season in a 2-0 loss to the Erie Seawolves. Cruz hit leadoff 0-for-5 with four strikeouts. Hitting second, Robert Hassel the third. He went 0 for 3. Brady House 1 for 3 hitting third. And the cleanup hitter, Yo-Yo Morales, 1 for 4 on the night. Up in AAA, James Wood and the Rochester Red Wings were rained out for the fourth consecutive evening. Now back to the show.
While we're talking relievers, we got this email from Mark Masters. You can always email the show, natschatpodcast@gmail.com. On the last installment of the podcast, we got into the conversation of, well, how many truly great relievers have the Nats had in their time in DC? Not so much guys who've had like individual great seasons, because there have been good reliever seasons for the Nats, but guys who have been good, truly good, over multiple seasons. Writes Mark, quick comment about the last episode. Al's great point about the Nats never having a consistent great reliever for years got me thinking, how many of those types has the entire league had over the last 20 years? Not many. Kimbrel, Jensen, Hader, who else? I guess there have been less total than there are teams in the majors. Would love to hear Al's and Mark's thoughts on this. I think Al's point is still valid, by the way. Thank you for that, Mark. You know, I actually said to myself after the show, how many guys have there been like that? There really aren't that many in terms of like relievers who are truly good over, say, a 3, 4, 5 year period span. Now, I still would come back to over 20 years of Nationals baseball. You'd like to think that you could have one of those guys, at least someone who was good, say, for 3 years. You really have not had that. And that's been a point of frustration. That's why we've seen so many different closers, so many different quote-unquote ace relievers for this team over the years.
Sure. And I think it goes to the point that I mentioned the other night, which is very often their best relievers have been guys they've acquired either in season, like a Mark Melancon, even a Sean Doolittle at the time, Ryan Madsen, Daniel Hudson, those types, or somebody that they signed in the offseason hoping to get something good out of them. And what they have not had very many of are those homegrown relievers who get called up and maybe start out as a, you know, middle inning guy and then gradually work their way up to pitching at the back end over the course of several seasons. Honestly, the one who probably comes closest to fitting that description, what I just explained there, is Kyle Finnegan, who wasn't officially homegrown. He was picked up from the A's as a minor league free agent, but he had never been in the big leagues before. And he started out that first year as just, you know, one of the last men in the bullpen. And now he's worked his way all the way up to being closer. I know he's not truly established and has not been consistently great year in and year out or even month to month, but that's probably the closest they've had to a success story as far as developing a late inning reliever from within. But I really don't think there are that many across baseball anymore. It's such a fickle position, as we've talked about. And, you know, it's also free agency and just the way things move around. There aren't that many who stick long term. Outside of Clippard, like I said, I think Doolittle when he was healthy, Daniel Hudson, but that's a shorter period of time. You're right. They have not had anybody who is just guaranteed, you know, is going to be good. Maybe Craig Stammen way back in the day before he went to the Padres, he wound up having a nice consistent career, but it's hard to do. And it's harder to find those guys and turn them into those kind of relievers, I think.
Yeah, and even like Doolittle, really good in 2017, 2018. Obviously, they won the World Series in 2019, but his best, at least regular season work, was 2017, 2018. Things then started to tail off for him. So like you got two really good years out of him, but then things started to decline a bit. There is a paradox here too, because in a time in which starting pitching has never been more scarce, it feels like, in terms of guys being really good, guys being healthy, and guys eating up innings, it feels like relief pitching has never been so fickle. So, you know, this is an era in which you really could use reliable, trustworthy relievers who you can have be good for you season in, season out. But that's hard to find. Like, good pitching period right now, it feels like, is as hard to find as it has ever been. And getting guys to stay healthy is, of course, half the battle, but finding guys who are consistently good is a big part of the battle, too.
And maybe for better or worse, this is part of the reason that Mike Rizzo and Davey Martinez believe the best path ultimately to success is to have good starters who go deep in games, because it's asking for a lot to have a number of relievers cover all those innings. Now, that may not be the general philosophy around baseball at the moment. It certainly does seem to be the philosophy here, and maybe that ties in with what we've seen as far as their reliever performance over the years.
Yeah, it's an interesting philosophical thing, because certainly great starting pitching, especially starters who stay healthy and go deep into games, that is a scarce resource. So if you can have that, you have a big time advantage over the other teams. The problem is it's so hard to have that. So is that a realistic way of building a really good team? It's hard to say. You know, the hope obviously is that guys like Gray and Gore and Cavalli and Rutledge and Irvin end up panning out to where you have the makings of a rotation that can be really good again. But boy, that is a tough way to go. It's just, it's hard to have that, you know, 3-4 starting pitchers who are at least decent, who stay healthy, who eat up innings for you season in, season out. That's tough.
I agree. But also think about this. About 3 years ago or so, what was the fad across baseball? It's openers, it's bullpenning and all that stuff. And in that time since then, I feel like it's reversed a little bit. That has not necessarily proven to be as successful a long-term model of success as Tampa Bay and a few other teams that were really good at it tried to suggest. I don't see other teams necessarily being as successful with that. And so maybe around the sport, there is starting to be a little more appreciation for good starting pitching and deep starting pitching saves a lot of other parts of your team and makes it a lot easier to assemble a bullpen. And so as hard as that is to do in today's sport, maybe you are better off going in that direction. And, you know, we'll see if the Nats can rebuild a rotation again the way they used to have it. They're not there yet, but it does seem like that's at least the model they're trying to go after again.
There's another interesting thing, too, that's happening with pitching. I was actually reading about this in a piece on The Ringer last night. So MLB apparently is conducting this big time study, this massive deep dive into pitcher injuries, and it's an MLB sponsored thing. It's not something that necessarily has been like talked about a bunch publicly, but there's this understanding around baseball that MLB is doing this. MLB did this a few years ago trying to assess pace of play. And that's how we arrived at, you know, the pitch clock and some other things right now. And so MLB is doing this right now, commissioning a study to really get in the weeds on pitcher health and how to improve it, because it's really a problem. And it's a problem that has gotten worse. It's not getting better. I mean, it was about 10 years ago that there was a Tommy John surgery epidemic that was declared. Things are even worse now, a decade later. I don't know what's going to come of a study like this. I don't know that there is a great answer or a fix for improving pitcher health. It's an unnatural thing what these pitchers do, throwing baseballs 90 plus miles per hour. And we know the importance that has been placed on velocity. So you're not going to all of a sudden see pitchers not try to throw as hard as they can. But I think that is something to keep in mind of if baseball can ever get better at preserving the health of pitchers, maybe you can get back to starting pitching being what it can be. There's a marketing aspect too, and that is, you know, back in the day, right, the way you sold a game was the starting pitching matchup, right? And you'd look in the newspaper, what's the pitching matchup? And I feel like that has never meant less in MLB. What is the pitching matchup? Because now the question is, what's the pitching matchup? Who's going to last for 4 innings today or 5 innings today? And then it's like, it's right to the bullpen. So I think there probably are financial motivations beyond just not having to be paying millions of dollars to pitchers on injured lists. But also, I think that would bring back something special to baseball, having starting pitchers and starting pitching matchups be really meaningful again.
Yeah, agreed. And I think you saw in the some of the changed rules with the last CBA, it was a subtle little thing, but they capped it at 13 pitchers at a time on a roster. And part of the reason there is you had teams going to like 14 pitchers and really emphasizing the bullpens. And I think MLB realizes that from a marketing standpoint, the game is more enjoyable for fans when you do have big name starters who can go deeper in games. That makes for better drama. I mean, what's more exciting? A starting pitcher over 100 pitches in trying to get through a jam in the seventh or even eighth inning, or the third or fourth guy out of the bullpen coming in to pitch a clean inning in the seventh or the eighth? Now, the reliever may be more effective. That may be a better chance of your team winning in the long run. But from an aesthetic standpoint, it's the starter going deeper in games. That's the way it has been for a long time. So I do think MLB ideally would like to get back to that. And I think the thing that'll be interesting to see is you've had for a long time now this thinking that the way to prevent injuries for pitchers is to have them throw less. And there's always been this undercurrent from some old timers a lot, but even some, you know, younger people around the sport have said, no, it's the opposite. The more you throw, if you're throwing every day during a season and during the offseason, keeping your arm loose and throwing more, that's actually better for your arm's health in the long run. Max Scherzer kind of believes that. He throws a lot in the offseason until just the last year or so was a model of good health. So I'll be interested if the rest of the sport maybe starts to take that mindset back and say, You know, we don't have to be so careful with pitchers because in some ways by babying them as much as we do, that may be contributing to some of the injuries and they're better off getting into a program where they are used to throwing a lot more regularly.
It was in 2014 that the famed Dr. James Andrews pronounced Tommy John surgeries, quote, an epidemic, end quote. In 2014, there were a total of 156 Tommy John surgeries, UCL surgeries across Major League and Minor League Baseball. Okay, so 2014, 156. Take a listen to this. Last year, 2023, 263 total UCL surgeries across Major League and Minor League Baseball. 2014, James Andrews says epidemic off 156 UCL surgeries. 2023, 263 UCL surgeries. And by the way, Minor League Baseball now is smaller than it was in 2014 because of the contraction in Minor League Baseball not long ago. Whatever is being done is not working. Certainly things can be better. And, you know, we all hope like heck that things get better. So we shall see. You tell us what you think. Hit us up on X at @Nats_chat. You can email the program natschatpodcast@gmail.com. We have a YouTube channel that we invite you to check out. You can search for our YouTube handle. That is @NatsChatPodcast. And please click on the thumbs up button and please click on subscribe. We appreciate those things very much. We have a website, NatsChatPodcast.com. All Nationals radio highlights on Nats Chat are courtesy of 106.7 The Fan. For Mark Zuckerman, I'm Al Galdi. We thank you for listening and we'll talk to you next time on the Nats Chat Podcast.
He's coming home. Safe.
You sure this kid's 19? And if I'm Cole Hamels here, I throw over to first. Just they're going to play on the momentum here.
The headlines remind us daily: the world is a dangerous place. The elites in charge say everything's fine, stop noticing. But you know better. And your gut knows that time is short to prepare for a world that is four missed meals away from chaos. My Patriot Supply has helped over 3 million families become more self-reliant and is the company Americans trust to prepare. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure their best-selling three-month emergency food kits. Each contain delicious breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Secure at least one food kit for each family member. For a limited time, save $200, plus get free shipping on all their Ready Hour 3 month emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour foods. My Patriot Supply also has solar power generators, water filtration units, biomass stoves, heirloom seeds, and critical survival gear. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.